episode 7 of Geek's Journey to Nature, a podcast at dudmanovi.cz. Hello and welcome to episode 7, A Geek's Journey to Nature. This is a podcast at dudmanovi.cz. It's recorded live thanks to Mumble, a server. Well, that's a bit of software, but it's the server that we connect to is provided by linuxbasics.com, and we thank them greatly for their assistance and help in doing that. What have we got in store this week? Well, we've got some updates, some news. We're going to talk a bit about technology, how this podcast is powered. And that's really right. Let's just see if we can turn down that music. I thought I'd remixed it so it'd be quieter. So first, a few updates. Well, when I started to do this blog this morning, I had edited the show notes, kind of a guide what I would talk about, but I went back to log in to my WordPress blog, and somehow, I'm not sure, I think maybe my wife or my son had tried to log in to somewhere else, and the admin... I rely upon Firefox to remember my passwords, and for some reason, maybe someone had clicked on remember, and the password had been incorrect, so... I had forgotten what the password was and had to go and reset it through, I think it's called MyPHPAdmin, where you can access the SQL database and change it. So I quickly found some instructions how to do that on our friend Google, and all is well, and I got back in. Bit of a relief, really. Another note, I tried to use Ardour version 3. A new version came out instead of Ardour 2. People have been getting excited about it, and I thought it looked great. But when I installed it, it looked great. Really nice colours and everything. But just pressing record and then stop seemed to crash the whole thing. So I can't be doing with that while I'm in the middle of trying to do something sensible. So I've reverted back to version 2. But I had to reset stuff up, and that was a bit of a pain. But it didn't take long, and it was good practice. What other news and updates have we got? Let me look at my notes. Oh, yes, our cow, Teresa Tereska, still hasn't given birth. She's out grazing today with her daughter and two friendly horses. And every night I wake up in the middle of the night, go and check. Have a look in the morning, go and check. Because when she gives birth, it's good to go and help her a little bit, dry off the little calf. Because at night she is chained to one place where her food is. All the cows are at night brought home. That I'm only worried that... You know, she gives birth, it comes out the back end, and she can't turn around enough to help dry the cow off and lick and what have you. So, probably it's no problem. I remember one year, I think the first year, about 5 years ago, when she gave birth to her first son, who was called Albert. We woke up in the morning, and I went out to have a look, and there was this kind of big creature there, and it looked strangely like our dog. At the time, we had a Bernardine dog. And he was massive and kind of a bit fluffy and silly looking. But the thing is, this little bull, as we later found out, called Albert, he looked a different colour. But he was loping around and very active. I was very surprised. So I had to catch him first and then get him to drink the milk and what have you. But what else happened? Well, my wife had a bit of a panic this week. She was just going down past our house to a neighbour's, and on her way back with a bucket in hand to pick up some apples to give to the bull and the cows for the evening, she was confronted by this big pig running towards her, and she had about 10 seconds of panic, thinking, oh my God, how have our pigs escaped, you know, and now they're out on the road and we're going to have to try and herd them back. And then she realised it was the neighbour's pig. And although it's never nice when any animal escapes, if you have animals and if some animal escapes and you realise it's not yours, it's such a relief because, you know, you're not responsible for herding them back. Anyway, my wife quickly herded the big pig back up the road to the neighbour's house and knocked on their door. But she wasn't so sure if she could herd the pig because he seemed very stubborn and determined that he would go past. But all was well, and the biggest relief is it wasn't our pigs. What else is there? We're rushing through the news here because I want to get on with the main feature story. I've mentioned last week that I've selected a guinea pig to kind of do some homebrew research here. Now, I don't want to mention his name specifically. There was a bit of clash in times, and he actually fell asleep when I was going to chat with him yesterday. To give him credit, it was very late in the evening or early in the morning for him, and he'd had a long day, so we'll reschedule. But his initials are BB, and you would recognize him by the depth and the silkiness of his voice. So we're hoping to get him back on, and we're going to be talking about healthy food, and hopefully he has agreed to be a guinea pig for his benefit and ours and your benefit, so he can kind of do a little impromptu scientific study here. It's a scientific study that's been done thousands, if not millions, of times over, back into the eons of time when people weren't suffering from any health-related or societal-related problems, and we were all happy. But sometimes to believe the repercussions of these simple changes in our lifestyle and what we eat and do, we need to retest them. It's not always easy just to believe what we read or something. And fair enough, you know, we should test and collaborate collaborate, if that's the word, ourselves, these things. So that's what our friend BB has agreed to do, and it's just a matter of catching him. What else? I want to speak just at the end of this podcast briefly about some more things with Debian and Ubuntu. I outlined last week, perhaps in a bit of a haphazard way, my frustrations or discoveries with Ubuntu, the software distribution based on Debian. I have made a few more discoveries. Whether they're completely accurate or whether I'm misunderstanding, that's definitely possible, but I thought I'd share and discuss them just briefly, and I'll carry on my research. And without further ado, let's get on. So the feature for this episode is, and this is reading from my notes, 10 years compressed into perhaps an hour. How an English computer programmer ended up owning cows, horses, pigs, chickens, and speaking Czech. What is Czech, you say? The Czech language. Not the English language, the Czech language. And after all this time, is still into tech, but is perhaps a little more discerning. What started it all is free and open source. Yes, that is absolutely true. Anyway, I hope that's kind of a primer, but what my intention was, if I'm sitting comfortably, maybe my wife will bring me a cup of coffee or a hot cup of tea, because I am English after all, is I wanted to outline what my experiences were and how I got to where I am. I'm realizing as I do these podcasts, it is quite a difficult thing just to sit down and chat to yourself. And it's along the way, it is my intention just not to edit the things, so you can really hear what I'm like. And I'm not going to spruce it up, you know. How it is how it is. So how did it start? Well, as a young kid, I would call myself a young hacker because I liked literally to hack things apart and look in them. I had a cupboard full of old electrical things or old things that our parents had thought they won't use anymore, and we'd somehow got them, some old wireless or radios, some old bits of computery things or something. No, that's probably not true. Maybe there weren't so many computery things in those days. Anyway, I had a cupboard full, and like all best hackers, I took them apart, and at the time I didn't have the skill to put them back together again, so I hid them carefully at the back of the cupboard so no one would notice, because I know that my mum would be a little bit upset if she noticed that I'd destroyed things. Well, that was where it all started. I was big into technical Lego, and I love building and playing with things like that. I think I did think that I would be an auto mechanic at some point, but I'm pretty pleased I'm not, because I think the scope for comprehension is a little bit limited, really. Not to diss on auto mechanics, but I think computer technology and science is a wider field than just fixing or mending or expanding on cars, you know. But anyway, I slipped into, like most kids, I'm not sure they really have any comprehension of what they want to do. They've got the career services and they're just told they've got to pick something. You know, you've got to move on from school and go and do something. So I went to college and then to university, first in engineering and then in computer science. Graduated from computer science after the 3 or 4 years and started to be a computer programmer. But I was infected at university by the concept of open source Slackware. I think there was a teacher at my university called Bob Dickinson, and maybe I will get in contact with him again, the University of Hertfordshire in England. And he was a big inspiration, bit of a wacky, long-bearded, sort of open-sourcey, Linuxy type. No insult meant, Bob, but maybe it's a compliment, in fact. Anyway, he was big into Emacs and Slackware and all these kinds of things. And the first distribution I tried was Slackware on 14 disks. You know, downloading them at the university because not many people or nobody had internet at home back in, I think it was 96 or 98, something like that. And Slackware from 14 floppy disks. Go home, install it. Oh no, one of the disks is corrupt. You've got to drive back to the university, download. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was infected by the bug of open source. Just the concept that you had the freedom. You know, you could look to see how something was implemented. You know, you could learn from what somebody else shared. You could see it running, you know, compiled. You could try to learn the whole... Basically, you could learn if you had the interest. And if you didn't have the interest, but you wanted to have it to be something different, you could make it into a commercial thing. You could pay somebody to do it. But you needed to give and pass on that freedom, i.e. share your changes, share your modifications, share what it took for you to be able to build it. You know, the know-how, the gubbins behind what makes it do its thing. So I went in and I worked at different places. I was quite fortunate in a way at the jobs I took, because I never really kept one for more than a year. I jumped, getting good pay rises on each jump. I spent some time in the City of London working for like some financial banking consultancy. So I had some good experience being a consultant for the financial industry. Never a particularly good one, but it was interesting experience to see how they behave, you know, getting involved and seeing what salesmen are like, and it was kind of behind the scenes a little bit. And then I worked for some more proprietary software, getting into Java. But along the way, you know, I was pretty fortunate. I had a lot of free time, and most of those jobs had fast and openly available internet access. So, you know, in my spare time or any additional time I had, I was able to research and search to my heart's content. You know, Google at that time had come into its own, so it was really easy to find stuff. And to be honest, perhaps even now, you know, you could easily get overwhelmed with any pursuit or study. And that's exactly what I did. I've got to thank all my employees at the time. They didn't really notice what I was doing or even demand too much from me. But I was developing a problem all the time during those years, and that was pains in my hands and stress in my shoulders from the bad posture, the too many hours of staring at a screen, you know, a kind of tension and stress to do things quickly and get results, you know, in a performance-related way. Oh, my cup of tea has just come. Thank you very much. And you'll still try to prevent everyone from shouting out there, will you? Okay, great. Thank you. I gave them strict commands not to be shouting at all while I'm doing the podcast, but that's no guarantee. In a nice way, they shout. Sometimes angry, but... it's a family after all, and we're human. Anyway, I developed these problems and pains in my hands. I had some injections. You know, I remember vividly going to the general purpose doctor, the GP in England, and the sort of incompetence that she put an injection in one wrist, and you know, she was pressing and pressing on the plunger at the top, and it just wouldn't go in. You know, it was so painful. She banged it in my arm, right in my wrist there, some cortisone or something injection. And And it wouldn't go, and it ended up the needle was sort of blocked at the end, so she got a new needle injected. The bottom line was, it made no difference. It still was hurting. I was having some sort of work paid for, massage and physiotherapy, and it was a pain that was more one of those nagging, constant pains, you know, and it creates a kind of frustration, and it just kicked me in the backside and reminded me, do I want to be doing this the whole of my life? Do I want to be sitting at a computer? Is it something that I want to do? So fairly quickly, based on all the free time I had, I started looking for more jobs. A quick reminder, if you've just dipped into the middle of this podcast, you are listening to Dudmanovi.cz, and this is episode 7, and we're just talking about a geek's journey to nature. So, back on, where were we? Yeah, so I had these injections, it made no difference, and I started to look to see for some alternative. I got interested in ecology and eco-villages. I realised I needed to get away from the work and to find some place. So, basically, I found an eco-village, which I felt some affinity with and seemed interesting. The one I chose was called Falcon Blanco in Ibiza, Spain. Well, an island off of Spain. And I thought, that sounds cool, you know. Go and see what these people are about and learn something. So I arranged with my boss to take a 6-month break. In my mind, I didn't intend to come back. Maybe in his mind, he didn't intend to employ me. I don't know. But I think that he probably did. And actually, I did come back after 6 months. Or 5 months, and I worked there another 2 months just for some spending money doing a kind of different job. So I must thank those employees. They were really great at Marant. Actually, they've changed their name recently, been bought out by another American company, so I don't know, they've probably changed their name again. But I rented my house, which, you know, I had a mortgage on, and it was a bit stressful, but I found someone to rent it, put in it with an agency, and I packed all my bags and I travelled off. And the experience I had for 6 months was quite phenomenal, to be honest, because it was a very special eco-village. They had concepts of eco-ness, but it was really about facing your preconceptions and your sense of reality. And that might sound strange, but their method of doing it was that their way of income was to go around the bins and the sort of dumpsters on the island of Ibiza. They also had agreements with quite a few supermarkets in the main town, where we would go and pick up the disposed wooden pallets, because they were quite expensive to dispose of and to transport back to the mainland, because, you know, there was this bottleneck of the ferry line. And in exchange for picking up those pallets, they would allow us to, and they would deliberately put into a certain place at the back of their shops for us, all of the out-of-date products, you know, the cans and tins, damaged things, and we would go and pick up all of that, and then we'd go back to the little sort of oasis, home away from home, and sort through it and take the things which we thought had more value for ourselves to eat, and then sell. And there was a shop on the place, on the property, and people would come, so there'd be a lot of like washing powders, some foodstuffs. It was amazing, really, the amount of stuff they threw out. The island of Ibiza is a big tourist resort and really quite affluent, but at the same time very wasteful. You know, you can get all your clothes and everything from the dumpsters. In fact, I remember one time our computer broke. It stopped working, and you know, we just sat there in the evening, and we put out the intention. It sounds a bit arty-farty or new agey. You know, I was going along with them at the time, and I'm always trying to be open to new experiences, so throw myself into it and experience it. But, you know, put the message out there that we need a new computer. And lo and behold, we get in the big dumpster diving, pallet picking up van, go off to Ibiza the next morning. I think it was me and one of the girls. And down by a dumpster was a computer. We took it home, you know, installed, I think it was XP at the time, and it worked perfectly. There was absolutely nothing wrong with it. I think it even had a monitor. So we got a monitor, a box, an old box with a PC in it, and it worked fine. So We had a new computer. Anyway, that was the island there. There was an associated problem. You know, the guy there, because you're picking up rubbish and a lot of it can seem useful, it's very tempting just to keep accumulating. And it slowly, quite slowly, became apparent to me that even if we clear up all the rubbish that he had accumulated, he was accumulating more at a faster rate, and it was an impossibility to keep up. That there were literally pallets and pallets of stuff, and it was our job to kind of sort through it or store it, but then nothing was done with it, you know. So it became really a massive fire risk in the summer, and often pallets then would be, you know, left out in the rain, and quickly it would become kind of useful goods to it'd be transferred after a few rain-ins and washings to complete absolute rubbish that had been rained on and spoiled. So I realized it wasn't really a future, and I actually needed a place of my own, so I was in charge. And what I really wanted as community wasn't some kind of haphazard eco-village, is I wanted to find and founder my own family. So I had a brother who'd already gone to the Czech Republic. He'd been sucked there by an au pair he'd fallen in love with in England. And we'd all met in a pub together, and there were three Czech au pairs, and he'd very quickly narrowed out the one of them that he liked the best, and he was a very fast mover. And likewise, he quit his job and moved to the Czech Republic before me, about 3 years, 4 years before me, 2 years, 3 years maybe. Anyway, and got married in the Czech Republic, and built his own little house, and has a nice life. Now he has three children, maybe four even, actually, going very big guns at it. Anyway, so I thought it would be nice, you know, my twin brother is in the Czech Republic, why don't I at least come and see if it's not possible to settle in some region which is close-ish, you know, trying to, you know, we're going to move far away from our parents, but why don't we at least, us brothers, us twins, stay kind of close, you know. So I came out, I found eco-villages, and there's something called woofing. It's called willing workers on organic farms, and if you're a young person looking for opportunities to travel on budget, and to maybe go to farms, maybe to help out in a more sort of open-air environment. You don't have to be necessarily a big ecologist, but it's a great way on a budget to travel and to meet different people, see different lifestyles. But so there's this thing called woofing, and I found a kind of position at a place in Czech Republic near Olomouc, which isn't actually far from where I'm living now. And I stayed there and helped the guy for about 4 or 5 months, and I was kind of interested again, you know, should I make my own family inside an eco-village, or should I be, you know, completely independent? And again, there were problems with that guy, that he was quite an activist, pushy ecologist, very well-meaning, but upset a lot in his life by what's happening in the world, and trying a little too forcefully and aggressively to see and create change. And it was a wonderful learning experience, to be honest, to be thrown in, and well, voluntarily I put myself into all these positions and became intimate with these people, so I must thank them all along the way. But you know, have to make my own way and my own decisions and be my own boss. So I left that place, a little bit of a conflict, but it was time to leave. I through another friend that I'd met from there, I found a flat to rent in the local city, which, to be honest, was a massive contrast. I'd never lived in a block of flats. Always had at least some garden, and I'd spent almost a year with like outside life, making and constructing, building, destroying, you know, very practical, down-to-earth lifestyle. And it was a bit of a contrast to be suddenly thrown into a block of flats. But I was doing a little bit of teaching. Not that I really needed the income to teach English, but more to sort of integrate myself, learn a bit more Czech, and meet people. So I did that for a while. Quickly realized that teaching English to people who aren't really self-motivated or engaged isn't really my thing. I'm And to be honest, I'm a wonderful teacher if somebody is passionate, but if they just feel like they should, you know, to get a job, or if they're not really interested, then I'm not going to push anybody, you know, and I don't believe in that kind of teaching model. So I gave up that. Actually, at the same time I was doing that, that was when I met my wife. And it was a very interesting meeting through another mutual friend who just kept saying, you've got to meet Vera. You know, you just have to meet Vera. She's so lovely. She sings so beautifully. And she wants a family. She'll be perfect for you. And, you know, he kept saying that when I met him, but he never arranged to get us to meet. And, you know, it seemed a bit strange to me, so I never pushed it. And the funny thing is, he kept saying that to my wife as well, to Vera. He kept saying, oh, you've got to meet Neil. He's really lovely, you know. Oh, and I think she said, oh, and he's really rich, you know. And the funny thing is now, when we reflect together, that actually put my wife off completely, because she didn't want to meet some rich, spoiled Englishman, you know. And actually, she had some inclination that I was black. And she had a little bit of prejudice towards that, you know. Or actually, she said she had this image that I had a leather jacket, and I was some leather jacketed black Englishman, which is very funny. But we did eventually meet, and the guy invited me to his little birthday party, and of course Vera was there as well, and it was very funny because we both had the feeling that we, of course, will get married, have children together, and be living together for many, many years to come. And that is exactly what happened, you know. Yeah, of course, he mixed up the telephone numbers when we asked him, can you give me her number? And she asked, can you give me his number? That he gave us both the wrong number somehow, and we were waiting a week or 2 weeks. And surprised, which was interesting. Now there's somebody on Mumble who is it? It's Breeze, who is having problems with his audio and can't hear. But he's not in my channel right now. Just a quick reminder, this is episode 7 of Dudmanovi, A Geek's Journey to Nature. And we are recording live using Mumble. As I've said before, we're about half an hour into the episode now, and I'm probably going a bit slower and drawing it out longer than I'd intended, but maybe we'll make it a two-part episode. You can catch this live, as a nice guy there called Breeze tried to, but had problems with his Mumble audio and said he's looking forward to listening to the recording instead. So thank you very much there, Breeze. And but you just come to the website, dudmanovi.cz, and the instructions are there on the left. There's a countdown to when the next live recording will be. And if you've got any questions or you want to join in the conversation, we've got a little forum area over on the Linux Basics forum. I'll put a link in this show note and somehow integrate it into the dudmanovi.cz website. Anyone interested in how to pronounce the dudmanovi.cz domain name, it is dudmanovi.cz, and that is our family name here in the Czech Republic. It's a Czechized version of our family name. I just mentioned that because on a recent episode, I think 122 of Linux Basics, Dor said some very kind things about me and the podcast, and he also said he wasn't sure how to pronounce it. So there's a quick help to you, Dor, and thanks a lot for all your help. You're a good, funny guy. Anyway, back on with the episode. So I'm now in the Czech Republic. I've met my wife, and she is at that time studying a terribly difficult and stressful university. She's a terribly determined young lady, and she was studying Japanese studies combined with English and Russian, I think, at the same time. She was very crazy. She spent 2 years in Japan, and she had just come back from Japan and was continuing with her studies when I met her. So, you know, fate brought us together, and we were combined. But it was terribly stressful, and I was just trying to help her with her English studies and be patient until she'd finished. We both quickly realized that the best way to get to know each other, because we were a bit older at the time, we were both almost 30 or 28, 30, and we weren't ready for just messing about. We wanted to see, you know, is this the one? Will I marry you? You know, should we have children together or not? So we decided to move in together to save costs and to sort of test, you know, to know each other intensely and to test to see if we could tolerate each other. So we did that fairly quickly, to be honest, after about 2 weeks of meeting. And, you know, I was really pleased because I could move out of that horrible block of flats, which is called a panelak in English, in Czech, which literally means flats made from panels stuck together, which is very funny and very true. So I escaped and we moved there, and it was very nice, very small place. So we had like one little room, and it was the top of the house, so the ceilings were so sloping in that you would bang your head, you know, if you stood up too quickly. But we had love to fuel us, you know, and we were living on the fumes of love, so it made it all worthwhile. Anyway, so it was about a good 4 months while she was finishing her studies, and then she'd had lined up a very well-paid job as an interpreter, a Japanese interpreter for a Toyota, massive Toyota factory that was being built in the Czech Republic. So the problem was, it's a very male-orientated environment, and my wife is a short, soft girl, you know. And it was very, very overwhelming, to be honest. And the Japanese culture that they'd imported, and the insecurities between the new Czech employees and the Japanese culture, because the Czech employees were being treated like kind of children. They were being taught how to screw up screws in plastic fenders of cars, and it was taking so long for them to get on with their actual work and to be like Czech workers that they were used to, that there was a lot of insecurities and conflicts. And my poor little wife, not then wife but to be, was stuck in the middle of all this. So she had a kind of a nervous breakdown, a tension. And without any hesitation, I went and picked her up and brought her home, and quickly then realized that, you know, if we're going to have a family, she didn't need to do that for the money. You know, I'd already budgeted, and I had like 5 years of a 5-year plan worked out, that I didn't need to find a job for 5 years, because the Czech Republic was really economically advantageous for me. I had some savings from my well-paid job in England as a computer programmer, and I'd been pretty good at saving up. And also the house I'd sold, I was very lucky. It was sold at a profit. The house prices just were magically up at that time. You know, I was stressed when I was selling it, thinking, is it going to suddenly plummet now? Is it going to plummet? Because it seemed like it was artificially high, and I could then have been in the negative, you know. But I was lucky and it didn't, and I had savings, and I tried to schedule, sort of plan how long they would last and what I would spend my money on, and I was living very, very cheaply at the time. So we, God, I'm really drawing this out, so apologies, I hope this is still interesting. If you want this to be more interesting, come along and listen live and ask questions and interact, and then I won't be tempted to draw it out so long. So there's a challenge out to all of you. There was a guy today, Breeze, who tried, and I challenge anybody else to try. And it also make it more interesting, because I'm interested in listening to other people as well. Back on, we're about 35 minutes. I had a reminder in my left ear, a big bing bong that you couldn't hear 5 minutes ago, reminding me. So yeah, carry on. Let's see. So we went and got a very cheap old Czech-made car so we could travel around and easily look for houses. more or less one of the first houses we found was, because I already had in my mind that I wanted some kind of homestead. I was already inspired by some sort of organic vegetarian growing. They were like extreme macrobiotic vegans. I wasn't quite that extreme. I didn't quite see it, but I was always open and I was naive. I was happy to get inspirations and learn from people and sort of integrate myself into environments, and then, you know, from what I see and hear, try to judge if that's you know, sound, or if it has a future, or how do those people live off the kind of fumes that technology creates, you know. So I knew I needed a place with some land and space, so we found a place, and it was a pretty big oldish homestead that needed fixing up. The old parents had died, and the young, now sort of 50 odd children, I think there were four children, they'd all moved off somewhere else and weren't interested in the house. And to be honest, it had really been left to disrepair. There were holes in the roofs, and we decided fairly quickly. We fell in love with the place. It had massive gardens, and it had about 4,000 square meters, like directly connected to the land. But the biggest thing that I really liked was there was an apparent possibility to buy up to another 20,000, that's 2 hectares or about 4 acres of land, which was the original sort of farming land connected with a homestead. And that was right behind the actual homestead. You know, there's a kind of pattern in the Czech Republic villages that you'd have like a central circle of houses, and then at the back of each homestead, sort of fanning out like a pie, like a big circle, you'd have each of those homesteads, the original ones, would have a piece of land. Of course, in recent years, last 50, 100 years, the children have, of each generation, have progressively sort of squeezed houses into the sort of front road facing land, and then they've built land, you know, houses behind, so it kind of becomes messed and mishmashed and squeezed. But more importantly, the pressure on the land behind, that was the original mainstay of the homestead, is diminished or even just lost, you know. And then in the 1920s onwards, or 1910, the pressure of socialism to unite all the land together and basically have all the independent homesteaders working for what was called the JZD, which I'm not sure what that really means in Czech, but basically the co-op farms, you know, that you as a farmer, you, for the advantage of having access to machines and modern technologies, you give up your land, you allow the fields to all be joined, you know, no more hedgerows in between them and individual paths. You can maximize your use of the land and, you know, increase the manner which you exploit and apparently the profits. I think if anybody looks into the details and thinks about it ecologically, not that I'm a big ecologist in the extremist view, but you haven't got to look far to see that it's really a misguided way. And this will be a subject for a future episode. I won't go down that rabbit hole too much, because I really would ramble for a long time. But we bought that house very quickly, and I thought we had quite a good understanding with the owner that within a few years, you know, once we've demonstrated that we really need the land, it wouldn't be any problem to buy that extra 2 hectares, 4 acres. He seemed really nice, so we went and bought the land. In hindsight, we perhaps should have listened to... When we were buying the land, we were up in the solicitor's office. You know, we had in those times, you could still buy a house by just getting all the cash out. So we went to the bank. We got, you know, I think it was about 1 million crowns it cost us, which said about 40,000 crowns, something like that. 30,000, I can't remember exactly, but it's about 1 million crowns. We took out the bank. We had in our brown envelope. We go into the office, the three brothers and the sister are there, and halfway through the negotiations or the signing of the contracts, the sister, the more sensitive of them, she collapses completely from sort of hotness and dehydration or whatever. And, you know, they're all about 50, 60, 70 years old, these brothers and sisters. So, you know, they have to help her out. She only just manages to sign it. And then when we get outside, there's a clamp on our car. You know, we'd parked and we hadn't put a ticket or it expired because we'd taken so long, I don't know. So we had to phone the police. And, you know, my wife and I were just so excited because we finally, the first time we possessed something that was ours, you know. And we're so excited. We can be the bosses. You know, we can make our own mistakes or successes. Anyway, in hindsight, because of the way it went with the relationship with those people, and our sort of constant asking, so can we buy the land already? You know, we need it. We have two horses. We have two cows. We need the land, you know. We want some grazing area. They just wouldn't sell us the land, you know. We were already using the scythe extensively for all our harvesting of hay and maintaining land. So, you know, that was for all of those animals. And, you know, we had goats initially, and we built up slowly. That's maybe another episode, but... The long and short of it was that we were cutting lots of neighbours' lands, neighbours' gardens, and doing that, it wasn't always possible to cut it at a time that they wanted. You know, we had to cut it when it was the next piece to cut, when it was the right time of year to cut. And, you know, we weren't interested to maintain English lawns. We wanted to cut just two, maybe three times a year to make hay with. You know, the grass had to be a decent length. And most of the neighbours were very happy, but there was one piece of land where, you know, we were relying upon it, and he didn't really care for... He was pleased we were cutting it, but, you know, there wasn't the communication, and this just really reminded me that sort of bad dependency if the land isn't yours. You know, we had animals to feed. At that time, there was one big farmer in the area that we would buy hay from if we needed any extra. You know, when we first got the horses, we bought hay for them because we hadn't sort of accounted for making hay for them, and we didn't have enough land to cut. But we were cutting in all the ditches, and, you know, I was pulling it backwards and forwards all with a hand cart. You know, at that time I didn't have a car or a trailer or hadn't trained or got any horses to do the work for me, so... Well, one day I just came home, and really enough was enough. Me and my wife just decided, if we can't buy the land, what is the point, you know? It was 5 years in already, and we had just finished fixing the house, you know, new roofs. We had gradually moved from one room around the house. As we fixed individual rooms, we would move to the next room, you know. As we fixed upstairs, we were living downstairs, then we moved upstairs so we could fix downstairs, you know. We'd already had our first child, and it was difficult to imagine moving somewhere else after doing all that, you know. But it was so critical to us to have our own land and to be in control that we just decided, right, let's go down on our bikes, we'll go and see the main boss of the family and just ask him, are you ever going to sell us a land? We went there and confronted him. To be honest, we weren't polite at all, because we wanted him to say no, because, you know, we didn't expect that he would just turn around and say yes. And, of course, he said, no, I will never sell you the land. Never, it won't be yours. So we knew then and there that we had to do something else. Something else happened at the same time. There was another sort of piece of land that we could buy, and... it wasn't directly connected to our land, you know. It was like a few like maybe 200 meters away. We couldn't see it from our homestead, but it was just 1 hectare. And we tried to negotiate with the ladies. There was like three old ladies, grandmas, who owned that. And we tried, or rather, an old lady and her two daughters, I think. But we tried to negotiate with them, and they were all for it. They were so excited, and we almost got to negotiation. And then my wife just phoned, and they said, no, we've decided not to sell it. And we were like flabbergasted, shocked. What? Why? Well, it turned out that they decided that they can make about 20 times the amount of money if they sell it for building plots instead. You know, so not only were we annoyed that we couldn't get it, but we were doubly frustrated that, well, no more damn little modernized houses with more town people, you know, nothing against you town people, but it's just in the long run, you'll probably realise that you need a bigger garden, and it'd be better if you even if you don't utilise the land now, build a house with a large area which is yours, you know, and don't be too close to neighbours, because the way I see it is we'll all need more land in the future, you know, to be more independent. That's a subject for another podcast. But so with those two things going on, we decided we've got to find a new house. So independently, my wife and I, on separate computers, we searched and searched, and the internet was amazing because we they had pictures, descriptions. You hardly had to visit places, so we could search hundreds of different homesteads, and I found this particular one. And it looked like ruins from a castle, you know. It looked very beautiful. It said it wasn't inhabitable, and that was a bit of a problem, because at that point already we had, you know, one child. We had an inhabitable house, you know. It wasn't perfect, but, you know, we were used to it, and it was safe and warm and everything. We had an inhabitable house, and we also had, you know, cows, goats, sheep, horses. So we had to find a place where we could move, where immediately they could live as well, you know. And we had all the husbandry equipment and lots of stuff. So it wasn't a matter of just packing some boxes and making sure it was close to our place of work. We had to move everything. The animals was more complicated. So anyway, we went to visit. Now I'm thinking I might save this for the next episode, because we're already at 46 minutes. And I'm just going to mention a few more things about when we bought that first house. It was funny, you know, you go to look at a house, and we're probably very naive people, you know, and we were just in love with the house. You know, it had great big fixed stone walls, and there was a massive barn for storing hay. It needed fixing, but, you know, it was very historic, and up in the loft they'd left a lot of the historic machines, and, you know, that basically had no value. It had, like, historical, it's like a value of interest to us, but most of it was unusable and really just fit for some sort of museum, just for entertainment, you know. And there's plenty of those in Czech anyway, because there was so much of this stuff up in people's lofts. But the interesting thing that we never noticed when we came was there was no running water in the house. You know, we only noticed after we bought it, and you might laugh, but you know, we just took it for granted that that was there, because there was an old lady who was living up to a year before we came and had a look. It had been empty, you know, a year. And there was also no toilet, you know, inside or outside. There was a kind of like a bashed down, knocked down sort of relic of some old outside toilet. But so they'd obviously done a lot of clearing up, and I think they'd cleared up any relics of an old outside compost toilet. Now I think about it, there was probably some old wooden thing and a hole that they'd buried. But when we spoke to neighbours after we'd bought it, that they described how much material and wood was in the yard outside, and that it was a real mess. So they must have tidied all of that up before we'd moved there, or we'd bought it rather, or they tried to sell it. But that was just an interesting tidbit. And actually, there was a kind of sink in the kitchen, and we just assumed, we didn't look carefully, that there was a tap, but there were no taps coming out the wall, and the only way to collect water was a bucket underneath the sink. But again, the passion of love and excitement and newness carried us along, and to be honest, still does today. So that's the end of episode one, I think, of what did I call it? Episode one of A Geek's Journey to Nature. How a computer programmer with, to be honest, a love for nature, but no experience or no sort of real practical understanding of what it means, tried to work things out. Quickly, another thing, I was also very naive during those periods, just assuming that all the villagers around would be interested in, you know, cutting grass with a scythe, or, you know, spinning wool by hand, or you know, cooking honest sourdough bread, or, you know, traditional ways of preparing foods. I just assumed that they would be interested in that, but we would when we first moved there, we'd be invited to people's house, and we would share with them our excitement, like as town people just coming to this, how we were excited, and they would maybe politely sort of nod, but I think inside them they're thinking, you're crazy, you know, what do you want animals for? Just buy a jumper, don't consider making it yourself, you know, and you don't want to keep a pig, it's too much work, you know, you can just buy it cheaper. And I think I've come to realize that a lot of them, not everybody, you know, I don't mean to put everyone into the same bucket, but a lot of people are doing it through doing the old things through kind of inertia, you know, and maybe they don't have the education for a better job or more money, so it's a way to make things a little bit cheaper. And maybe often it's the old people which are still keeping the animals, or, you know, want to keep a pig, but once they die, you know, the younger people haven't really, not in all cases, haven't really been integrated into looking for them or having that passion towards keeping them. Saying that, there is a big growing trend of people, especially people who come to our courses, where we do courses on how to use a scythe and cutting grass with ease, you know, for men and women and children, dispelling the myth that you've got to be somehow macho and strong to do it, you know, and it's an exhaustion, because it doesn't have to be. But we, you know, one of the advantages of doing these courses are we meet so many people just for a brief time, you know, one day, and we get to hear about the things they're doing, you know, and we've got a real feeling that there are so many people in the Czech Republic or even worldwide who are excited, you know, passionately excited, you know, not for a sense of profit, not for a sense of, I don't know, but just for a sense of excitement to see what's possible and get in touch with nature, you know. So that's a great thing that's happening. But a lot of them are really, thanks to Weston A. Price and the real comprehension of what is healthy food, people are returning to appreciate that keeping an animal, even if you intend to kill it, or if you're exploiting it by taking milk, and maybe if it gives birth to a cow, a bull, that you will kill it, but you try and in a respectful way to kill it, in a fast way, you know, and don't send it off to the slaughters and let it be stressed. Do it at home, learn how to do it yourself in a quick way, you know, kind of say a blessing before you do it, and thank the creature for his life and what, you know, there's a tear in my eye as I say that, because I really mean it. And you know, to integrate what we can exploit and use from animals, but making sure that we serve them and they serve us. A real mutual relationship of serving each other. Anyway, we're up to about 50 minutes here on the podcast, and come back next week for part two of A Geek's Journey to Nature, where I'm going to complete when we moved into our new homestead, which we've been here for now 5 years, and basically we started again from scratch, making a new homestead, fixing it all and struggling. So in the last 7-10 minutes, I wanted to quickly mention again this whole thing about technology. I'd meant this week to reformalize the structure of the podcast, you know. I need to get some sound bites in there, really just to remind myself and listeners the sort of motivation. I'm not quite sure how to do it yet, but, you know, this podcast is about technology. It's a tech podcast, but for me, I'm calling it real tech, you know, because I was thinking about this. I listened to lots of tech podcasts, you know, computer and programming and Linux and, you know, that kind of tech, gadgets, you know. And I just quickly looked at the Wikipedia definition, and I've got it here at the top of my website, and it says, you know, technology is a making, modification, usage, and knowledge of tools, machines, techniques, crafts, systems, methods of organization in order to solve a problem. So I want to emphasize in this podcast, you know, technology needs, if it's going to be good technology, it needs to solve a problem, and that technology is about making, modifying, and using, and knowledge you know, of tools. It's not just about, oh, somebody else has the knowledge and they will sell us something. It's not just about a some gadget you buy. It's been my experience in the last few years that I buy a gadget like an iPhone. You know, I'm trying to be open. There was one point where I was, you know, trying to get rid of all these gadgets because they just create stress, and I was frustrated that they weren't serving their, you know, who was serving? Was I serving them or were they serving me? I was spending all my time just trying to get them to work how I wanted them to or how I thought they should. It's still my feeling quite a lot of the time that we're being treated like beta testers, you know? I love technology gadgets like the next geeky gadget loving person. But being a bit older and with a family now, I have other priorities, and I need to make sure that anything I'm using serves my greater purpose, you know, and the greater purpose of humans' coexistence with nature, you know, how a family integrates together, relations with the animals, you know, our ability to get the animals to collaborate with us, not through fear, but through collaboration and good leadership. This is something else I would like to talk about in another episode, is techniques and knowledge and tools for horse training and dealing with animals that I learned, which actually extend completely and very well to humans and children especially, and which I've been using, I feel, quite successfully on my own wife and my children. And all of those things I call technology, you know, and according to this definition in Wikipedia, are technology. So kind of the purpose of this podcast is to highlight this perversion of the term technology towards things we can just buy. Yeah, I'm not against people making profit, but I'm tired, for one, of being a beta tester, although I enjoy testing and playing with things. I just think we should be honest with what it is. You know, if I buy some computer and it's sold as a development board and, you know, you can tweak with stuff, that's great. But if I'm sold something as a finished product, then I want to know it's a finished product. Wow, you can hear the music coming in. And if I'm going to be good at doing this, I should really respect that 2-minute music before the end. So before it really forces me out... And let's have a quick look. I've got a few more minutes. I'm going to quickly mention about Ubuntu. After last week's sort of semi-rant, I didn't want to be too unfair. I'm not sure how it sounded, but I've still been looking into understanding how distributions work, you know, whether it's derived from Debian. You know, Ubuntu is derived from Debian, and then there are so many derivatives of Ubuntu. I started a few different threads over on the forums at Linux Basics, really trying to understand how these things are. You know, I was looking at, some licensing trademarks. It was called like a trademark agreement for the Ubuntu. And I'm not completely sure I agree with or understand it, or that it's really, really a very good... trademark description there. You know, I've got a lot of questions as I read it. I have the feeling that they are actually restricting what you're allowed to do to the derived works from Debian. You know, they take it from Debian, and I feel that they are actually restricting what you can do. There didn't seem to be much mention of, you know, there are no restrictions as long as you share the source code. Because it was my understanding with the GPL, you're able to sell stuff, you're able to make money from it, but you must pass on the same freedoms that you got, you know, when you got the works. And for that to be true, it's my understanding you just need to share the source code. You know, the whole trademark issue using the Ubuntu trademark, I think that's completely valid. You know, that is owned by Ubuntu. It was a surprise for me that anything Ubuntu, not just the U, but anything with Ubuntu, so that's Xubuntu, Lubuntu, Kubuntu, all of those are trademarks of Ubuntu. That is my understanding. I could be completely wrong, and I'm happy to be corrected. But it made me look at it, you know. I'm running out of time now, just another 30 seconds, so we'll draw this to an end. But I did have some interesting discovery, which I'll talk about, or go and look on the forums, about Ubuntu's use of something called, I think, the Popularity Tool, Popularity Contest, which is a Debian package. And it didn't seem to me that Ubuntu are following the rules. That Debian, I'm not sure Debian is forcing you, but saying. So that's going to be a discussion for next week's episode. Hopefully now we'll see how this information, the muse is coming in, and we're off. Come back next week for dudmanovi.cz, and thank you very much for listening.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.